President Trump laid out a plan this week for America's space program to commit to returning astronauts to the moon and then journeying on to Mars. The president's signing ceremony Monday at the White House included former and current astronauts standing behind his desk. Let's take a listen.
We will not only... The directive I'm signing today will refocus America's space program on human exploration and discovery. It marks an important step in returning American astronauts to the moon for the first time since 1972 for long-term exploration and use. This time, we will not only plant our flag and leave our footprint, we will establish a foundation for an eventual mission to Mars and perhaps someday to many worlds beyond.
The directive didn't come with a specific timeline or how it would be paid for. Jeff Faust is a senior staff writer for Space News, where he covers space policy, commercial space, and related topics. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right. Well, this announcement, big deal or not big deal?
It's a first step, but it's not the only step in developing a program to return humans to the moon. It really now makes it official national policy that the U.S. will send astronauts back to the moon. But as you mentioned, there's a lot of details that have yet to be worked out, and that includes how long this will take, how much it will cost, and just exactly how NASA will carry that out. And those are some of the issues that we're going to see getting developed in the months to come.
Came across one news outlet that said this directive is an 18-page plan that was published in 2010 by the Obama administration, and one paragraph has been revised. Is there anything to this? Is that true?
Yeah. Specifically, what the president signed on Monday was a memorandum that took the national space policy that President Obama signed in 2010 and changed that one paragraph that called for astronauts to first go to a near-Earth asteroid before going to Mars, and instead say, well, we'll go back to the moon before going to Mars. So in that respect, that is, in effect, what this new policy does. It's most likely that there will be further changes to national space policy in the months and years to come. Every administration creates their own national space policy and puts their own particular imprint on it. This is just the first step in the Trump administration's plan to carry that out. But it's one with a particular focus now on going back to the moon, something that some previous administrations have talked about doing as well.
So is this strategy all that different then from what President Obama had been pursuing in his presidency?
Well, the Obama administration had decided that it was not worth the expense to go back to the moon. Obama went to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida in 2010 to announce elements of his policy, and he said, in effect, well, we've done that. We've gone to the moon. We don't need to go back. We want to go further into space. What the Trump administration has done is said that, well, the moon is actually a good stepping stone if you want to go to Mars. And going back to the moon and getting experience with human spaceflight beyond Earth orbit is a necessary step for going back to Mars. So both the Trump and Obama administration's policies are in agreement that Mars is the long-term goal for human spaceflight. The difference is what steps you take to get there. The Obama administration wanted to go to asteroids first. The Trump administration wants to go back to the moon.
So the space shuttle program, that was benched in 2011. And what has NASA been doing since then?
Well, NASA's been doing actually quite a bit. Since the shuttle was retired in 2011, it's been working on a new generation of launch vehicles and spacecraft designed for missions beyond Earth orbit, something the space shuttle couldn't do. They're working on a rocket called the Space Launch System, or SLS, that is designed to launch a spacecraft called Orion, which at first glance looks a little bit like the Apollo spacecraft from the 1960s and early 70s, but is a much more advanced version of that, designed to carry people to various destinations beyond the Earth, including to the moon and to Mars. We've had astronauts and continue to have astronauts on the space station. We've had a cruise on the space station actually continuously now for 17 years. And actually there was just a spacecraft that a Russian Soyuz spacecraft that landed early this morning, returning three people, including one NASA astronaut from the space station. Another Soyuz spacecraft is going to be launching on Sunday morning to send three new people back up to the space station. There are already three people currently there as we speak, so they'll be back up to a crew of six. And NASA's been supporting developments by companies such as Boeing and SpaceX to develop spacecraft that will be able to take over the duties of transporting astronauts to and from the space station, allowing NASA to free up its resources on that beyond Earth orbit exploration with SLS and Orion and other programs to come.
So, Jeff Faust, we've been hitching rides to the International Space Station on Russian capsules, is that right?
That's right. Since the shuttle is retired, we've relied on the Russians to get our crews to and from the space station. With the commercial crew vehicles that Boeing and SpaceX are developing and are scheduled to make some key test flights next year, we'll end that reliance on the Russians and be able to take over those crew transportation duties.
Jeff Faust is with us. He's a senior staff writer for Space News, where he covers space policy, commercial space, and other space-related topics. We're talking about a directive this week signed by President Trump that aims to get astronauts back on the moon and journeying on to Mars. And we're discussing this policy. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you think about a return to human space exploration? Should we be setting our sights on the moon, Mars, and beyond? Is this something you'd want your tax dollars going toward? 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, Jeff, we know that space travel is quite expensive, very expensive. Congress just passed a tax plan that the Joint Committee on Taxation estimates will add $1 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. Is this something that the U.S. government can really tackle right now?
Well, it's important to keep in mind in looking at the big picture that NASA is a very small part of the overall federal budget. NASA gets a little under $20 billion a year right now. That is less than 0.5% of the federal budget. So if you're looking to cut spending in order to reduce the deficit and the debt, there are other places that you may be able to find more cost reductions than in the space program. The question is, looking forward, is how expensive will this return to the moon and travel on to Mars be? And we don't know right now because we don't know exactly what that program will look like. We know it will probably involve the development of some additional spacecraft like a lander to take astronauts down to the lunar surface because the Orion spacecraft doesn't have that capability. You may require other components like habitats for the crews to live on when they're on the surface, other capabilities like that. But will those be developed by NASA? Will they be provided by international partners? Will they be provided by the commercial sector through some sort of public-private partnership? There are various ways you can approach this to try and minimize the expense that is involved. But there's going to be some costs associated with a venture like this, depending on what shape it takes. And the question will be, will NASA's budget increase to accommodate that, or will cuts have to come from other agency programs in order to be able to afford a return to the moon?
How important are these public-private partnerships going forward, like NASA with SpaceX?
Well, the commercial crew program is one big example of a public-private partnership. NASA is providing funding to Boeing and SpaceX, but both of those companies are contributing their own funding to develop those vehicles with the potential to use them for other applications beyond transporting NASA astronauts, perhaps for taking tourists or commercial researchers or other people into space, for an example. NASA's already used that partnership approach for the cargo spacecraft that currently take supplies and equipment and experiments to and from the space station. SpaceX and another company, Orbital ATK, developed those vehicles under public-private partnerships, with NASA providing some but not all of the funding to do so, but with the companies being able to then take those rockets and spacecraft and potentially offering them to commercial customers. And SpaceX has actually been very successful in that regard, in that the Falcon 9 rocket they developed as part of that project is now winning a lot of business for launching commercial satellites, a lot of the satellites that we rely on for broadcasting television programs.
Jeff Faust is with us, a senior staff writer for Space News. You can join this conversation about America's space program, 800-642-1234. What do you think about a return to human space exploration? Join in, and we'll return after a check of the news. The U.S. retired the space shuttle program in 2011, 3 decades after it began. During the program's span, the 5 shuttles flew 135 missions. Since the program ended, the U.S. has been forced to rely on Russian rockets. A new directive signed by the president this week orders NASA and contractors to go to the moon and beyond. We're discussing the directive on this Hour of the Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. SpaceX and Boeing both have billion-dollar contracts to send American astronauts to the space station. Space News senior staff writer Jeff Faust stays with us. You can bring your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think about a return to human space exploration? Should we be doing deep space exploration? What should we be doing in space? 800-642-1234. Jeff, we all recall the great space race in the 1960s, the two Cold War rivals, the Soviet Union and the U.S., vying for the dominance in spaceflight activity. Bring us up to speed today. How much international competition and politics are we seeing right now in the world of space exploration?
Well, it's very different from the Cold War space race, which was between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, in that there are a growing number of countries with their own space programs and their own ambitions for space exploration and sending humans to the moon and beyond. And besides the United States and Russia, China is perhaps the most prominent country, in that they have launched a series of robotic spacecraft to the moon. They have some more of those planned for launch in the coming years. They have talked about eventually sending humans to the moon, although exactly when isn't clear. It probably wouldn't be until at least the mid to late 2020s, if not perhaps even later. Europe has its own program with that's involved as a partner on the space station and would likely be interested in partnering with the U.S. on any human return to the moon, but has done its own share of robotic space exploration missions. The same can be said for Japan. It very recently enacted a new element to its space policy that called for cooperating with the U.S. on any human lunar exploration program, because Japan wants to send its astronauts to the lunar surface and thinks the best way to do that is to cooperate rather than develop their own capability. You also have India, which is a rising space power. It's found a niche in launching satellites inexpensively, attracting customers from around the world. It will be launching a robotic lunar mission next year. It'll have an orbiter and also have a lander and rover, and they have some ambitions for future missions as well. So there are a lot more countries out there, but in some cases they are cooperating with each other and not necessarily competing with each other, like in the Cold War space race of the 1960s.
Is the moon able to handle, or can it accommodate, all this interest and activity around the world for space exploration?
Well, the moon is a pretty big place, so there's lots of room for these countries and commercial space exploration efforts and maybe others to come to go to the moon. The question will be where they will go, because some places on the moon are going to be more interesting than others. And one of the most interesting places will be the poles of the moon, because there's likely deposits of water ice in craters at the poles of the moon that are always in shadow. So they stay very cold and can keep that ice in place for a long period of time. And that ice can be a useful resource for future exploration. Obviously, crews can take that water and drink it and use it for life support systems, but you can also break it down into hydrogen and oxygen and use that as rocket fuel to send spacecraft back. And in the process of doing so, save the mass that you have to send to the moon, and therefore save money for doing so. So there may be some sort of competition to find some of those best landing areas in the poles of the moon, but otherwise there are a lot of interesting places on the moon, and there's a lot of room to accommodate various countries and companies that want to go there.
Let's go to Dave, who joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi. My question for Jeff is the following. NASA has proposed a deep space gateway project over the next several years, and would have at least three modules in place by 2024. But an interesting thing is that they're only showing a use of that, you know, projected space station of maybe 30 to 40 days a year. So it will largely be vacant. And so it seems to me that maybe the, you know, a missing piece of this that hasn't really been fully flushed out is what commercial partners and what international partners may do in terms of utilizing it and actually making it a gateway, as opposed to just something that's largely vacant and orbiting the moon and nobody's up there using it or actually getting us closer to a fuller utilization of the lunar surface.
Well, Dave,
your perception of that?
Yeah, Dave, thanks so much for calling in. Let's let Jeff respond.
Yeah, well, let's introduce the concept of the Deep Space Gateway, which is something that NASA introduced as a proposal. It's not yet a formal program. Earlier this year, the idea is to put basically a mini space station in an orbit around the moon or otherwise in the vicinity of the moon. It would, as Dave mentioned, have a few modules. There'd be a habitat module where the astronauts would live, a module for storing supplies, a power and propulsion module to provide electricity and to move the whole gateway around in the area around the moon, and the potential to add other modules too, perhaps in the time to come. NASA introduced it initially as a way to test some of the technologies they would want to use for future missions to Mars. By doing it out in the vicinity of the moon, you're outside of Earth orbit, you get some experience of operating in deep space, but you're also just a few days away from Earth in case something goes wrong. And NASA's current idea is to build that up in phases, basically adding one module a year for a few years, and then having crews stay for 30 to 45 days or so at a time on these, as part of this assembly and test missions. But as Dave mentioned, there's the opportunity to use this as a springboard for missions to the lunar surface. If NASA or an international partner or a commercial partner wanted to do missions to the lunar surface, the Deep Space Gateway would be a great staging place to set up those missions, to store, say, a lander that you would send the crews down to the lunar surface, or have astronauts on the gateway operate remotely spacecraft on the lunar surface without having sort of the long time lag you would if you were trying to do that from Earth. So there's several opportunities.
Using
there.
It more like a staging area, the gateway?
Yeah, as you would, instead of going directly from the Earth to the lunar surface, you would go to this deep space gateway in lunar orbit, and you would set up your spacecraft, you'd transfer your crews and so on to go from there down to the lunar surface.
Vice President Mike Pence has said that establishing a renewed American presence on the moon is vital to achieve our, quote, strategic objectives and the objectives outlined by our National Space Council. What strategies, objectives are we talking about here?
Well, Vice President Pence in particular has emphasized the need, in his view, to restore American leadership in space. And it's very much an open question of whether the U.S. has or has lost that leadership in space. But what he has argued that he's very much tied it to human spaceflight and having the ability to launch astronauts from the U.S. and then to be able to send astronauts to the moon and eventually to Mars is certainly one aspect of leadership in space exploration, and that's what he's been trying to promote as a means for doing so. It's worth keeping in mind that I think most of the rest of the world considers the U.S. A leader in space today, regardless of our human spaceflight capabilities, given our role as the leading partner on the space station and our extensive suite of spacecraft missions that are exploring the solar system and beyond, that gives us a lot of leadership in and of itself.
Jeff Faust is with us, a senior staff writer for Space News. We're unpacking the directive this week signed by President Trump on Monday to send astronauts to the moon and to journey onto Mars, deep space, looking at what this directive means for America's space program. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you think about a return to space exploration? Should this be a priority for America? Is this something you'd want your tax dollars going toward? And what questions do you have about the future of space exploration? 800-642-1234. We heard from Alexa in Green Lake in an email saying this is exactly what our nation needs, something we can all get behind and support as one nation. Alexa says, I'm hopeful that this happens quickly so we can come together instead of being so divided. So Alexa here, Jeff, taking very much a political point here of something all people can get behind.
Well, you know, a lot of people look back to the Apollo program and the surge in patriotism and love of country that came from being able to send astronauts to the moon and doing something that had never been done before. And I think a lot of people are hoping that a return to the moon can recapture some of that same spirit.
And then Bob in Superior emailed with the opposite side of the equation. This makes no sense. Going back to the moon is a waste of time and money. We have so many problems to solve here. Homelessness, healthcare, education, Bob says, that we'd be foolish to make this a priority with our tax dollars. Let private companies explore space. Jeff?
Well, that's a common view as well, and the question comes down to is how expensive will a human return to the moon be? That's one of the big questions that we don't yet know the answer to. And then where does that money come from? Does it stay from within NASA and take money away from science or other programs of the agency, or does it come from elsewhere in the federal budget? And exactly what are our priorities, and can we afford a return to the moon along with all these other pressing priorities that the country has? Hopefully the answer is not an either-or question. Hopefully there is a way that we can find to support human space exploration along with these priorities so we don't have to make those tough choices. But we're in interesting political times, so that's a hard prediction to make.
Bob and Alexa, thanks so much for those emails at ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Tom, who joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hello. My question is, with the cost of space exploration, there's a lot of debate of sending humans versus unstaffed or unmanned expeditions. If you can comment on, you know, where's it better to spend our money?
You know, that's a popular debate of human versus robotic space exploration, and it really comes down to what is the reason you're doing those missions in the first place. I think you can make the argument that if the primary reason is to do science, is to understand, say, the origin and nature of the moon or Mars or the solar system in general, robotic missions would give you the best return for the money, because while an astronaut can be more capable than a robotic spacecraft, an astronaut's a lot more expensive to send, so you probably get a better bang for your buck from the robotic standpoint. But I think there's a lot lot more to space exploration than just science. There is the opportunities for opening new frontiers, for developing new markets, new commerce. There's a lot of national prestige that is associated with space exploration, which certainly we were talking about in terms of the Cold War space race of the 1960s and so on. Those are things that can't necessarily be done by robotic spacecraft alone. And so there are roles there for humans to play in human spaceflight. It really comes down to the question of what are your priorities when it comes to space exploration in terms of science versus national prestige versus commerce versus any other factors that you can think of in terms of that issue.
Tom, thanks for calling in with that question. Jeff, while President Trump didn't announce any timelines for a mission to either the moon, the Mars, or the solar system for that matter, logically speaking, realistically here, how far away are we from a mission to any one of these locations?
The Deep Space Gateway that NASA's been talking about is something that the agency thinks it can put into place into orbit around the moon in the mid-2020s. So a human landing on the moon would probably take place after that. The question would be, does it come in the late 2020s? Does it come in the early 2030s? That comes down to budgets and technologies and how you come up with it. But it's hard to see a human return to the moon before the latter half of the 2020s, simply given what the current plans are and what the likely funding that will be available and the technical capabilities to be able to do so. In terms of going to Mars, there had been some discussions, particularly during the Obama administration, of going to Mars as soon as 2033. To go to Mars, there are launch windows that open up roughly every 2 years, and 2033 happened to be a particularly advantageous one. That mission wouldn't necessarily have landed people on the surface of Mars, but would have at least gone into Mars orbit and to do some science and exploration there.
What do you mean by a launch window opening up?
Well, in essence, you have to go to Mars, you have to go launch when the planets are aligned, when the Earth and Mars are in the right spots in their orbits. And those launch windows open up, like I said, about every 26 months, a little over every 2 years. So that's why when you see some of these past robotic missions to Mars, they seem to come every 2 years, and that's because of those launch windows. And once you launch, it takes 6 to 8 months to get to Mars. And so you would spend some time at Mars before coming back. So a human expedition to Mars might be a 2 to 3 year mission, which is something that's never been done before in terms of how long people have spent in space. We've had astronaut Scott Kelly, who spent a year on the space station last year. That's the longest a NASA astronaut has ever spent in space. So there's a lot of research that needs to be done in terms of the long-term effects of spaceflight on the human body, all the technologies you need, the life support systems to be able to do a Mars mission. So 2033 might be a little optimistic. It might take longer. I should also keep in mind, though, that Elon Musk, the founder of SpaceX, has talked about doing human Mars missions in the 2020s with a large rocket that he is developing, although a lot of people are skeptical about some of those schedules that he's put out.
Well, technology alone has changed so much since the 1960s. What do we really stand to learn or gain from a new moon mission?
Well, there's a lot of science that can still be done on the moon. The Apollo missions literally just scratched the surface in terms of understanding what the moon is like, and scientists would love access to different parts of the moon, particularly some of those polar regions and so on.
And we're going to have to pause right here and get back to that thought with Jeff Faust. He is fielding our questions this hour on America's Space Program. He's a senior staff writer for Space News. You can join in 800-642-1234. Do you think this directive is a giant step forward? Join in. We'll be back after this news. The White House said in a statement that the new space policy reflects recommendations from the National Space Council, a White House advisory panel that President Trump appointed earlier in the year. President Trump held a signing ceremony Monday ordering American astronauts back to the moon. We're talking about the directive on this Hour of the Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NASA retired space shuttles in 2011. Right now, Americans currently hitch a ride to the International Space Station in Russian capsules. That would change under the directive that we're talking about with Space News senior writer Jeff Faust. He covers space policy, commercial space, and related topics. You can join in the conversation about America's space program, 800-642-1234. And Jeff, before we went to the news, you were talking about what knowledge we can gain by being on the moon, by hanging out there. Why is it important to be there?
Yeah. Well, you know, that there's a lot of science that can still be done. The Apollo missions just started that, as well as some of the robotic missions. So there's a lot to learn about the moon and what that can teach us about the formation of the solar system and other scientific topics. Also understanding what resources are available on the moon that could be used for future space exploration. There's the water ice at the poles that we previously mentioned. There's obviously resources in the lunar rocks and soil that could be harvested for use. Some people have talked up the possibility of extracting from the moon an isotope of helium called helium-3 that could be used for future fusion reactors, although those fusion reactors don't exist yet and probably won't exist for decades. So that's sort of a long-term resource at best, but also a possible resource to use. So there's a lot to learn and a lot that could potentially be used from the moon that could support space exploration activities both here and on to Mars and beyond.
Let's go to Rosie, who joins us from Ashland. Hi, Rosie.
Hello. I have not heard a mention of all of the side benefits from the original space program. If you've been to a hospital recently, all that telemetry on your bed originated with the space program. The miniaturization that was needed to lighten the weight of the original capsules in your phone. Granted, it took a while to get there, but it originated with the effort to get our guys in space.
Rosie, thank you so much for those comments. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, those are what are called in the space industry as spin-offs. These are technologies that were developed in order to carry out space missions, whether human or robotic, but then find applications elsewhere. And as you mentioned, there are a whole bunch of these spin-off technologies that have found their way in various applications, you know, in almost every industry. And NASA, you know, does play up these spin-off technologies. They actually put out a publication every year outlining the latest technological spin-offs that have come from the agency. The thing is, those are sort of a side benefit that you get from doing space exploration. They're not the reason you do space exploration in the first place. If you wanted to develop those advanced technologies, you'd be better off investing directly in those technologies rather than investing in the space program. But they are a bonus that you get from doing space exploration for science or prestige or other applications.
So the question is whether freeze-dried ice cream is a spin-off technology.
Yeah. Fortunately, freeze-dried ice cream is not a spin-off technology, and astronauts aren't forced to have to eat that.
Let's go to Pete, who joins us from Janesville. Hi, Pete.
Hello. I would be a full supporter of Rosie with all the spin-offs of things such as Velcro. I just feel like with there being no middle class left in the United States and being in Wisconsin, being a full supporter of science, but in Wisconsin, science does not seem to be a priority anymore, or many of our decisions are not supported by the science and the facts that come forward. And I'm driving on roads right now that have 6-inch crater holes in them, 2 inches of snow for the last 4 days, and there's no snowplow on my road. And so what I'm trying to say is, I'm a supporter of the prior caller that said that it should be private industry paying for that. And that's coming from somebody who's been down to Spaceville or to Huntsville, Alabama, to space camp for over a week in an international attempt. I would suggest that one of the greatest things is that we have other astronauts from other countries that get to know our astronauts. And there's peace up there is what they told me. And most importantly, while at space camp, my understanding is the only reason that we have human beings in space is so that human beings will support and fund space exploration, because without it, if we just do it through technology, which I think we can do for the most part, they will not fund the program. And I would have to agree with a lot of those things, I think.
Well, Pete, thanks so much for calling in. And Jeff, let's unpack those ideas there. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's one interesting point there in terms of the value of international cooperation in space. Given all the rough state of relations between the United States and Russia, especially this past year, but for the past few years, space has been one area where the two countries have continued to cooperate smoothly. We have Russian cosmonauts and American astronauts working side by side on the space station, flying up and down from the space station on Russian spacecraft, and that has been unaffected by the current controversies and the state of relations between the two countries in general. So that's one area where we've demonstrated that we can get beyond some of the earthly controversies and find a way to work together in space, and opens up the prospect of being able to do more of that in the future with more countries.
Let's go to Terrence in Madison. Hi, Terrence.
Hi, Jeff. This is I've been following your work for years, since when you were doing space politics, and I'm glad to hear you on my local station. I just wanted to ask the question that always gets brought up in the space politics area, as to, what are the odds that we'll actually get the budgetary funding for this? I know budgets are what scuttled, or part of what scuttled the Constellation program and any number of other programs. And I'm just trying to get a feel for whether or not that seems like it might be more likely to happen this time around.
Terrence, yeah. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. It's a great question. It's a multi-billion-dollar question. There is, will NASA get the funding to do that? And one of the challenges right now to answering that question is we don't know what exactly that program will look like. We've seen in the past efforts have to go back to the moon have been scuttled because of high price tags associated with them. In 1989, President George H.W. Bush talked about human return to the moon and going on to Mars, but it got a study that slapped a $500 billion price tag on it, and so it died pretty quickly in Congress. And then in 2004, when President George W. Bush talked about a return to the moon by 2020 and then going on to Mars, the cost budget increases that were projected but didn't materialize in the years to come for NASA's budget caused the pressures that led to the Obama administration in 2010 canceling that effort and making its own space policy. So I think to be affordable, we're going to have to rely a lot on international and commercial cooperation, working with other countries, working with companies and public-private partnerships, finding ways to leverage their capabilities and making the overall program more affordable for NASA. Because if it's another large government program, I don't see how it's going to be any more successful this time around than in 1989 or in 2004.
And Roy in Hortonville is going along those lines. Roy, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Earlier in the show, you were talking about the quote-unquote race for space. And I was just thinking at that point that it seems a bit of an arcane idea that we would get a lot farther if we had more international cooperation, which is somewhat how the trend in the conversation is going now. But is there anything really that's being done to foment alliances between what we might call our planet-based rivals with, say, the Soviet Union, and particularly China and India and some of the other emerging powers?
Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, another good question. There have been discussions between the United States and some of these other countries, particularly those that we're already working with on the International Space Station, about future exploration programs like cooperating on the Deep Space Gateway and perhaps missions to the surface of the moon. The one big issue is dealing with China, and it's actually against the law right now for NASA to cooperate directly with China on any sort of space program without getting a lot of prior approvals from Congress. And this dates back to several years, and it was linked in part to technology transfer concerns, but also human rights concerns in China by some in Congress. So it's very difficult right now for NASA to work with China directly. But as China's capabilities grow, I think at some point we'll have to revisit those restrictions and see how we can find ways to work together while protecting our own interests.
Well, Roy, thanks for calling in with that question. Jeff, what other space directives might we be seeing coming down the pipeline in the months or years to come? Is this announcement a standalone, or will we be hearing more?
Well, typically, every administration does their own version of a national space policy, and they look at not just NASA, but also the role space plays in the military and also in the commercial sector. And so I suspect that they will be looking at that. They have reestablished something called the National Space Council, which last existed in the George H.W. Bush administration a quarter century ago, to bring together the heads of various cabinet-level agencies and NASA to discuss some of those overarching space issues. So I suspect they will play a key role in helping develop that space policy and, for example, finding ways to best support NASA's needs, but also help establish a growing commercial space industry and ensuring that our military is able to make use of space capabilities as well, given the growing threats that they face to their space capabilities. So that's going to be an ongoing effort. But beyond that, it's going to be how do you implement this directive signed on Monday? You know, how are you going to send humans back to the moon? When are you going to do it? How much is it going to cost? Those are some of the key implementation issues that we'll see addressed probably in the months to come, starting with the administration's next budget proposal that'll come out early next year.
Lots of questions to keep an eye on. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure.
Jeff Faust is a senior staff writer for Space News, where he covers space policy, commercial space, and related topics. This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Cheryl Gasser is director of the Ideas Network and provided on-air technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.